The countdown to the state finals. In Urbana, the girls of Winterguard took the stage. There was no real audience to speak of. Is put on probation too. A Villa Grove roofer convicted of visa fraud and employing and harboring people who were living in the U.S. illegally, who were his Champagne-based business, has been sentenced to 3 years in federal prison. U.S. District Court Judge Sue Myersko said Thursday she would recommend that Ed Geyer, 47, serve his sentence in or near Pensacola, Florida, where he has been helping rebuild homes wiped out by an October hurricane that ravaged the Florida panhandle. Geyer did not have to immediately turn himself into Myersko, told him the Bureau of Prisons would contact him. The judge also levied fines of $30,000 against Geyer and $250,000 against Grayson Enterprises, a company owned by his fiancée, Kimberly Young. Myersko put Grayson Enterprises on probation for 3 years. Geyer pleaded guilty in October 2017 to unlawfully employing people who were living in the U.S. illegally. Following a bench trial in November 2017, Myersko found Geyer guilty of visa fraud and harboring people living here illegally. She also convicted Grayson Enterprises of the same offenses. I need workers. I trusted the professionals who told me they would provide foreign workers, Geyer said before Myersko imposed the sentence. I trusted a lawyer who I know now did not act according to law. I used bad judgment, and for that, I am deeply sorry. The 90-minute hearing Thursday in Springfield brings a close, for the time being, a criminal case that has culminated in Geyer and Grayson Enterprises being indicted in June 2016. The charges stemmed from activity that occurred between 2011 and 2014. It involved Geyer using the services of promoters to legally obtain visas to bring foreign workers to this country to do work for which U.S. workers are not available. What's not entirely clear is what will happen to a building at 309 West Hensley Road, C, formerly known as Quick Leasing, a company for which Young was president. Grayson Enterprises leased that building. Young is also president of Grayson Enterprises. The judge entered a preliminary order that Geyer and Grayson Enterprises forfeit their interest in the building to the government because it was found to be used by the roofing business to house the foreign workers. However, that building was sold for $3.1 million to a trucking firm a year before Geyer was indicted. Reviewing the facts of what she heard at a trial a year ago, Myersko concluded that Geyer faced between 41 and 51 months in prison and a fine up to $250,000 under federal sentencing guidelines. She also noted that the guidelines are advisory and that she has the authority to sentence outside of them. Although Geyer had no prior convictions, Myersko said he fell into a higher sentencing range because she believed he was aware that Young had supplied materially false testimony at trial about how the visa applications were prepared. As Geyer's financier, Young had a powerful incentive to fabricate a story on behalf of Geyer and Grayson Enterprises, Myersko said. The judge said she found no evidence that Geyer coerced Young to lie, but said he was aware of it. Young did not appear at Thursday's sentencing. As president of Grayson Enterprises, Young was represented by Springfield attorney Peter Wise, who entered the case after Myersko had rendered her verdicts. Also coming in at that time on behalf of Geyer was Urbana attorney Steve Beckett. The veteran defense litigators were left to sort out the trial strategy employed by Chicago attorney Andrew DeVote, who represented both Geyer and Grayson Enterprises, and to minimize the sentences for their respective clients. Assistant U.S. Attorney Eugene Miller argued for the 51 months behind bars for Geyer, and a fine of $1.25 million for Grayson Enterprises. Miller said the roofer was both exploiting a legal immigration system that exists in the United States and exploiting illegal aliens in this country. At trial, the government had presented evidence that in four different applications to the Department of Homeland Security for H-2B visas, which allow foreign workers to fill jobs that can't be filled with U.S. labor, Geyer submitted contracts that said he had worked line up when he had not. Miller said there were 136 workers who got to the U.S. who did not have jobs that had been promised by Geyer, and those who were employed were being paid in cash, with no Social Security benefits, health, or unemployment insurance. The defendant is making money and obviously not paying his fair share to protect American workers. He's avoiding his 6.25% into Social Security and his share of payroll taxes, said Miller, adding that practice allowed Geyer to undercut his competitors who are doing it the right way. Miller described the living accommodations for the workers as a warehouse where some slept in sleeping bags. The government contended at trial that Geyer knew the foreign workers were living in a building owned by Grayson Enterprises, which was intended to make their employment more attractive while paying them less than the prevailing wage. It also made it harder for authorities to find them. Beckett urged the judge to consider that Geyer was duped by so-called promoters who reached out to legitimate businesses and offered to make arrangements to obtain the H-2B visas for them to get the help they needed. Some of the more unscrupulous promoters charge high fees to the foreign workers to get the visas as well as the companies that need the workers. The defendant was naive. He relied on people that he thought were professional, Beckett said of the petitions that were supported by the fraudulent contracts. He didn't catch it and continued it, and opened himself to criminal liability. Use your discretion and see where he fits in the bigger picture, said Beckett, asking the judge to sentence his client to probation or a year and a day in prison. This case had been horrible. Ed Geyer can't do any business in Central Illinois anymore. Everybody thinks he's a crook, and he'll carry that forever. Beckett said some of the workers who obtained visas to work for Grayson Enterprises showed up but left without ever doing work. As to the illegal harboring, Beckett said the warehouse on Hensley Road was not the property of some sort of slumlord. It had been remodeled to feature small individual quarters for the workers, along with two kitchens and a recreation area they all shared. Wise's argument on behalf of Grayson Enterprises was similar. He called Miller's recommended $1.25 million fine just excessive. He reminded the judge that when about 30 workers arrived in Illinois in 2013, Young took them to Walmart, where she spent about $1,000 to buy toiletries and clothes to help them settle in, and took them to the Social Security office to get proper documentation. Shortly after that, these workers, to a person, left, Wise said. Regarding the illegal harboring, Wise said the government's characterization of the Hensley Road property was misleading, and evidence at trial was that the workers weren't there more than about 4 or 5 weeks. Calling this a squalid dump warehouse is about as far from accurate as you can get, said Wise, comparing the quarters to his children's college dormitory rooms. He also said that Young, being the president of both Grayson Enterprises and Quick Leasing, was an absolutely legal structure for the government to imply that to be evil or mischievous in anathema to corporate America, Wise argued. A $100,000 fine is sufficient punishment for Grayson Enterprises and sends a message of, you can't do this, but doesn't run the company into the ground. In his brief statement to the judge, Geyer, a father of four, told Myerscough he was a roofer by trade who did not go to college, but built his business through hard work. I want the court to know that my life has been forever affected by my mistake in judgment, he said. Only now working to put roofs on homes destroyed by the catastrophic hurricane on the Florida panhandle do I feel my life has meaning again. I cannot go backward, but I am going forward 16 hours a day to salvage as many houses as possible before the winter fully sets in, and I feel good helping people. I ask the court to impose a merciful sentence and to allow me the time to help those who need my help in the Panama City area, he said. The Green Street Strip Mall to be razed. Construction crews began preparing Thursday to tear down a Green Street strip mall on the western edge of Campus Town to make way for a $30 million six-story apartment building, according to a building permit sought by new owners. The 153-unit complex just east of the railroad tracks would include retail on the first floor and a gym for tenants on the second, according to plans reviewed by campaign zoning administrator Kevin Phillips. It's an apartment complex that will have commercial on the Green Street face of it, Phillips said. It looks like a pretty nice project. The plans were approved by the zoning department, Phillips said, but are still under review by the fire department's building safety division. A separate demolition permit was approved Tuesday for 24 East Green Street, and bulldozers were at the fenced-off site Thursday. The property was sold in November for $2.4 million and again in December for $4 million, according to the country's assessor website. It was apparently bought by Chicago-based real estate firm called CF Capital Partners, which could not be reached for comment. The owner listed on the permit was CE Capital Partners, which did not show up in the Illinois Secretary of State's database of businesses, but it is listed the same Chicago address as CS Capital Partners. CF Capital also manages Pacifica Champagne, a limited liability corporation created in November. Several tenants in the former strip mall have announced moves in recent weeks. The pole dancing studio Defy Gravity moved to Lincoln Square Mall, and the Champaign-Urbana Health District is moving its sexual health clinic to McKinley Memorial Presbyterian Church, 801 South 5th Street in Champaign. That location has closed due to the sale of that building, said Nancy Johnson, coordinator of the Health District's HIV prevention program. We will begin a new sexual health clinic next Wednesday, February 13th, from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. every Wednesday. And the leadership at Twin City Bible Church decided in November to close its Midtown location at the Green Street Center and combine it with its main Urbana location, though it may open a Midtown location again in the future. Phillips said the complex won't extend all the way to Springfield Avenue because the property doesn't extend that far. People have often asked us if it's going to be one giant thing from Green to Springfield, and the answer is no. That's a separate parcel, he said. The new apartment complex will be across the street from the West Quad Apartments and to the west of the large drainage basin that Phillips called Square Lake. The property slopes up toward the railroad tracks to the west. It's a challenging site because of the hill and the fact that it tapers off with Square Lake and the railroad tracks on the one side, but it looks like it will be a very nice apartment building, Phillips said. A lot more people are living in that area now, so we think the commercial is going to build up. Deal finalized with firm for superintendent search. The Urbana School Board has finalized an agreement with national search firm School Executive Connect, bringing its quest to hire a new superintendent and two assistant superintendents one step closer to completion. During Tuesday's board meeting, members approved the $28,000 consulting fee that covers searches for all three positions and limited expenses, such as consultant or candidate travel, focusing group expenditures, and secretarial support to $5,000. The board listened to five proposals from different search firms before settling on Minnesota-based School Executive Connect last Friday. Members Ann Hall and Paul Polowski negotiated the contract over the weekend. I think we need to let it be known that one of the reasons this firm was selected was because of their commitment and process and procedures to have a significant amount of public involvement and staff and search involvement in this search. Board President John Dimmitt said Tuesday. They particularly spoke to us about how much research they have done on our community and how issues and how much they would be able to help us in ensuring the superintendent process was open, transparent, and involving a large amount of our community. Dimmitt's comments reiterated a board pledge to increase transparency within the district after former Superintendent Don Owen and Assistant Superintendent Kathy Barber were put on paid leave in late November with little explanation. Another Assistant Superintendent, Samuel Bidom, was put on paid leave in last October after he allegedly attempted to secretly record a closed board meeting. He is facing felony eavesdropping charges in that incident. Other expenditures in the contract include advertising costs, fees to translate an online survey into French, and other translation fees for the search announcement timeline, superintendent profile, and the community outreach efforts. The board will also be accountable for cost of candidate interviews and related expenses and after the candidates have been presented. Polowski said, choosing School Executive Connect didn't cost much more than any other firm. They were all about the same price, he said. During Friday's open meeting, board members pointed to the importance they put on the firm's ability to search for national candidates as well as recruit a diverse group. They said School Executive Connect meets their criteria. I like the idea of when we were presenting to us that they studied us, the culture, so they know about the diversity of the schools, and they mentioned that, said member Benita Rollins-Gay. They looked at all these aspects, and I like to hear that up front when they're trying to hire a superintendent to such a diverse school. The health reporter is in. What becomes of patient medical records when a hospital is sold? Do they automatically go to the hospital buyer? That's up to the buyer and seller in each transaction. State law requires that your patient records be maintained for at least 10 years, but when a hospital is sold, the law doesn't specify whether it's the buyer or the seller that assumes responsibility for the records. For example, OSF Healthcare didn't purchase the patient records when it bought the former Presence Health Hospitals in Urbana and Danville a year ago. Carle, on the other hand, purchased hospitals in Hoopston and Olney with plans to integrate the patient records of those two hospitals into its own electronic medical record system. OSF did have an access to patient records at the former Presence Covenant and Presence United Samaritans Medical Centers for 6 months after its February 1, 2018 acquisition of the two hospitals, according to Deb Whitley, Regional Director of Health Information Management for OSF. Records for care delivered prior to the sale date at those two hospitals, renamed OSF Heart of Mary and OSF Sacred Heart Medical Centers, can be obtained through Presence Health, which is now part of Chicago-based AMITA Health, Whitley said. Whitley said OSF declined to take over the patient records from Presence because it doesn't want to store and maintain records that it didn't create. OSF did, however, upload from Presence the data it needed for a continuity of care document that includes some basic care information medical providers can access about patients who were at the hospital prior to the sale. This is basically the information needed at each of the two hospitals in Urbana and Danville for patient care, she said. What it's not is a complete patient record that a patient can obtain copies from either hospital. We have everything we need to take care of the patient, Whitley said. By the way, Whitley also said, OSF maintains its own patient records at the Urbana and Danville hospitals and other in its system for longer than the law requires, 12 years from the date of care. As for Carl's integration of records from its own hospital purchase of what is now Carl Hoopston Regional Health Center and Carl Richland Memorial Hospital, Carl Hoopston's electronic medical record is fully integrated into the system, Carl spokeswoman Jamie Mullen said. Carl Richland is on track for full electronic medical record integration in the coming year. In the wake of natural disasters, people lose hope, and we bring them hope again. For years, as member of the Air Force, Brian Romanski's hands touched intercontinental ballistic missiles designed to deliver nuclear weapons. Today, the minister's hands touch Christian believers as they are welcomed into the Baptist Church. Staff writer Tim Mitchell sat down with the 56-year-old pastor of the 50-member First Baptist Church of Muhammad to talk about his life, his ministry, and his devotion to the movie Rudy. Tell us about the event that led you to become a minister. It was not something that I had anticipated. I went to church and served in leadership positions in churches, but I never thought about ministry. It was not on my horizon. I was driving to a meeting in Milwaukee late one Sunday night, trying to sell a big multi-million dollar project. I didn't hear an audible voice, but while I was driving, I heard these words that Jesus spoke to Peter in John 21, "If you love me, feed my sheep." It was so striking. The words popped into my head out of nowhere, and the thought did not go away. It was such a powerful thing that I had a hard time concentrating on anything else. And one day, I shared it with my wife that maybe I should be thinking about something in the ministry. "You've got to be joking," she said. "We can't lose 2/3 of our income." She was not pleased with the whole idea at the time, so I talked to our pastor. I asked what he would think if I told him I was contemplating leaving my job. He responded, "So you are thinking about going into the ministry?" It was almost a confirmation of what I had heard. My wife and I talked about it. When there were layoffs at my job, I realized there wasn't as much stability in that job as I had thought. I finally turned in my notice and I quit my job. All this time, my wife supported me. She saw that God was working, leading us in this direction. I wouldn't have done it if she didn't support me. What is the earliest memory of church? I can remember sitting in the pew when I was a little kid, drawing on the back of a bulletin. My mom was telling me to be quiet. I can remember being in Sunday school class in the basement of that church. What poster did you have on the wall of your room growing up? I had a big picture of Uncle Sam saying, "I want you." What high school did you attend? Orin High School. There, I played on the football team, playing offense and defensive guard and center. We didn't have a very good team, but it was fun. I also wrestled at 105 pounds and 112 pounds. I think sports teach you to discipline and how to work as a team. How did you end up joining the Air Force? Well, at that time, I was looking for an opportunity to get an education. My family didn't have a lot of money. The Air Force paid a lot of my tuition. I went in for electronics at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. I laid hands on nuclear weapons all the time, the big silo-based ICBMs. Whiteman had the Minuteman II intercontinental ballistic missiles. I had 150 ICBMs in silos at various places all over the countryside. I was in the military 8 years, first at Whiteman and then at Chanute Air Force Base. I was an instructor at Rantoul. Which ministry are you most proud of? Disaster Relief. I am the team captain for American Baptist Men Disaster Relief. We have two disaster trailers. Whenever there's a disaster, we get the call. Recently, we were in Taylorville following the tornado, going to the roofs of houses to put up tarps, and this time last year, we were in Watseka following the floods, doing mold remediation and cleanup. We stripped away all the flooring, all the way down to the subfloor. We tore out insulation and drywall. We fogged the buildings with chemicals that kill mold. We were in Gifford the day after the tornado hit there. I helped coordinate a blitz build with Habitat for Humanity, and we built 3 houses in 2 weeks. On my birthday last year, I was in a plane flying to Puerto Rico to help with hurricane cleanup. We worked on roofs of churches. We spent the better part of the week repairing a large metal church building roof. We fixed 28 holes in the roof, and one of them big enough you could have dropped a car through that roof. Part of our ministry is not only helping people recover from the disaster physically, but also emotionally and spiritually. People lose hope, and we bring them hope again. You hear the people's heartbreak. I usually take at least one and sometimes 3 or 4 people from the church with me. What is your favorite hymn? In Christ Alone. It tells the whole gospel story in a succinct manner. It says our salvation is in Christ alone. If you could meet anybody from the Bible, who would it be? Jesus. I would be so overwhelmed, I would fall to my knees and break down in tears. It would be such an exciting and yet powerful experience. What is your favorite book of the Bible? I like the Gospel of John a lot. My call to ministry came from that. That is a very important part of me now. It is the gospel and where Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead and says, I am the resurrection and the life. Do you have any hobbies? I am a runner. I have run a lot of 5Ks and 10Ks, and I'm signed up to run the Christie Clinic Half Marathon. I run it in conjunction with WBGL's effort to fight human trafficking. When they started doing that, I started running. What is your favorite food? Barbecued ribs. My favorite place to go for ribs is Famous Dave's in Bloomington. What is your favorite movie? Rudy. I was serving on the board of Habitat for Humanity of Will County when that movie was made. One of our board members was a Notre Dame grad. We decided to do something with that movie for our Habitat for Humanity chapter. We made calls and got a hold of the director of the movie, David Anspaugh. He was able to coordinate for us to have the first showing of Rudy at the historic Rialto Theater in downtown Joliet. We had the director, the real person, Rudy Rutinger, and the actor that played him, Sean Astin. They were all at the event, and we raised a bunch of money. It is a great story about perseverance. A BMAT woman who had gone on the run after being ordered to report to jail was captured Wednesday afternoon by U.S. Marshals in Urbana. Jeanette Stevens, 33, who pleaded guilty to unlawful delivery of methamphetamine on January 25th and was sentenced to 8 years in jail, did not show up to Piatt County Jail the following Monday. Police at the time said she had fled with her 18-month-old son. The Piatt County Sheriff's Office announced Wednesday that Stevens had been apprehended, stating on a Facebook post that she was in custody. Child is located and safe. Good job, U.S. Marshals. The county's state attorney confirmed that Stevens had been transported back to Piatt County Jail and that the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services had taken protective custody of her child. She is expected to be arraigned on escape charges at 2 p.m. Friday before Circuit Court Judge Gary Weber in Piatt County Court. And I will see you for the second half of the News Gazette. Signing off.